Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books and Comic Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Woke, a host of the channel, and today I'll be talking with Dr. Chris Bishop about his book, Medievalist Comics in the American Century, published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2016. Dr. Chris Bishop is an honorary lecturer at the Australian National University. He's published widely on the history of late antiquity and early Middle Ages, as well as on comic book studies. In 2012, Bishop was awarded a Kluge Fellowship at the Library of Congress in the United States for his research, which led to the publication of this book. From its genesis in 1930s to the present, Bishop surveys the medievalist comic, its stories, characters, settings, and themes drawn for the European Middle Ages. Hal Foster's Prince Valiant emerged from an America at odds with monarchy, but still in love with King Arthur. The Green Arrow remains the continuation of a long fascination with Robin Hood that has become as central to the American identity as was to the British. The Mighty Thor reflects the legacy of Germanic migration into the United States. The rugged individualism of Conan the Barbarian owes more to the Western cowboy than it does to the continental knight errant. In the narrative of Red Sonja, we can trace a parallel history of feminism. Bishop regards these comics not merely happenstance, but each success, such as Prince Valiant and the Mighty Thor, or failure, as in Beowulf, Dragon Slayer, as a result and an indicator of certain American preoccupations amid a larger cultural context. Intrinsically modernist paragons of pop culture ephemera, American comics have ironically continued to engage with the European Middle Ages. Bishop illuminates some of the ways in which we use an imagined past to navigate the present and plot some possible futures as we valiantly shape a new century. The main takeaway is that the medieval is not past, it is not even medieval, but rather the use of medievalist elements sheds light on contemporary issues. In this interview, Dr. Bishop talks about the uses and abuses of classical and medieval texts in popular media, the value of studying flops, and how we might all misunderstand history for our own reassurance. Dr. Chris Bishop, welcome to the show. Chris, I was wondering if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you found yourself a classicist researching comics.
Well, thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks for having me on your show. How did I find myself researching comics? I've been a comic reader for a long time. I always liked comics as a kid. And I suppose that what happened is at some point in my study of history, in that trajectory, I became really interested in popular culture. I'm really interested in the way that popular culture reflects the history of the societies that create it. And I think that if you want to construct a less elitist view of history, obviously you have to look at pop culture, not necessarily interested in it as a literary art, although obviously some comic books are, a literary art, but I'm interested in them just as a piece of an indication of where a society finds itself. And so comic books are really good because you have a whole series of ideas expressed in them, and then you have a little indicator based on their how much they sell, how many of copies are produced. So I can actually say here's a comic that came out, and this is the year it came out, and in that year it sold, you know, 100,000 copies or 20,000 copies, or it sold only 5 copies and then it stopped. And so I can say, well, maybe there's a little bit, we can use that as a bit of a cultural barometer. Does this, the popularity of this comic tell us something about the society which consumed it, or does its unpopularity tell us something about the rejection of it by that society? So I thought it was a really interesting piece of pop culture to go into, to start looking at the histories of the societies that produced them. So that's, I think that's what got me into it. And as a classicist, I don't even know if I am a classicist, but because classics is a really privileged sort of a position. I obviously taught classics at the Australian National University for quite a few years. I've recently finished doing that, and I like it very much, and I still continue to read classical literature. But I am I'm really interested in the ways, I suppose, that our construction of a classical and a non-classical past is used to shape present national identities. Yeah. And so one of the things I think is really interesting, and this is a bit of a thing about my research generally, I've published things on medievalist texts, but I've also published things on classicist texts. And I think if anything, I would say within Western political ideation, and I guess that Western identity, is this constant conflict, I think, between medievalism and classicism. And I think it's really, what I tend to find, you know, just like, and this is, we can, you know, dig down on this a bit deeper, but in a general broad sort of a brushstroke, I think that in the history of Europe and European societies, that when they're attempting to establish nationalism, they like medievalist texts. They're really useful to use as part of a nationalist narrative. But then as they expand into empires, they prefer classical texts. And then that justifies imperial expansion. And then when empires break up, little bits of those empires then reestablish themselves with medievalism to establish their own national identity. And so I find this really interesting backwards and forwards between the use of classicism and the use of medievalism in modern European and European-based societies to justify modern nationalism. So that's, and then I could use things like comics. The book we're talking about is about medievalist comics, but I've also done lots of papers about how comics have used classical imagery as well to establish certain things. So I think that's how a bit of a ramble, but there you go.
Yep, perfect. And very interesting points, which I wish that kind of needs like a whole extra episode to talk about, but we'll try to touch on some of that today. And could you get us started off with kind of a layman's definition of medievalist? And is that swords and sorcery? Is that the medieval? Where do we see that?
Yeah, it's such a difficult one, isn't it? The minute you start, and you're really aware of this, of course, being an academic, the minute you start to use specific terms, people like to sort of start to argue about what that term exactly means. And so one of the things, it's funny, in this book, Medievalist Comics in the American Century, one of the things I've tried to do at the very beginning was to distance myself from a particular ideology of words. So yes, it's called medievalist comics, and I give a bit of a definition. But one of the things I said in the opening is, like, I want to get away from the idea of medievalism because it's a really contested issue. And what medievalism is and what neo-medievalism is and what academics want to fight about there. And so right at the beginning of the book, I said, I'm not going to talk about those things. I gave a brief few pages about, you know, where people stand on those and why it's so contested and how academic terms like, you know, studies in medievalism, which I've published academic papers for, you know, spend issue upon issue arguing about which is which. And I was really amused to see that some of the criticism I received was that I didn't then go into those terms. Like, I literally started off saying, I'm not going to talk about those terms because I think they'll just obscure what I'm going to talk about. And then people said, why didn't you talk more about those? And I'm like, because I didn't want to talk about those. So I realize these things are very contested, and I understand that. I suppose when I talk about what I want to say about medievalist is that it's basically the conscious use of an often imagined medievalist past, but we need to understand that everything we write about ourselves is still about ourselves. So whatever we use about the past, whether it's a classical past or medievalist past, it's imagined. It's what we're trying to imagine it was like, but we're probably trying to say something about who we are now. So swords and sorcery, absolutely. It could be anything. I think anything that imagines itself as medieval, whatever that could possibly mean. So And there's also that big dynamic in medievalist texts, I suppose, and I think this comes out in the book, between the utopian and the dystopian medieval. So if I want to imagine that my modern world is good and getting better and the march of history is going on, I like to bring up a dystopic medieval past where everything was dirty and horrible and everyone's teeth fell out by the time they were 12 and they went blind and everyone had dreadful lives. If I want to say that my modern world is falling into rack and ruin, then I'm going to reach for a medieval past that was beautiful and idyllic and everybody sat around in sunny glades with unicorns and all that sort of stuff. So neither of those imagined pasts are true in a real sense, but we're using them to try and navigate a present. So anything which looks back to an imagined medieval past, I guess I would say would be medievalist.
All right, thank you for that. That gets us oriented. So to also get us oriented, could you please introduce some of the comics you examined and give us some background on how you chose them? I really liked your selection in this book.
Did you? Why
yes,
did you like the selection?
Yes, very much. I like the balance between the popular and especially the unpopular in there. And we will talk about that hopefully a little
bit
more.
Yeah. There's so much you could talk about. There's actually so many choices you can make. And I went through lots and lots of, when you're doing these books, I went through lots and lots of research, look at different things. And I found, I suppose, that a lot of what I wanted was comic histories that told particular stories. So a lot of the stories will be the same about why a particular medieval past is used. So I wanted to look for things that told a unique story. And because I was, for that project, attached to the Kluge Center in Washington at the Congressional Library, I was really interested in American stories. Why did America, a country which had no experience of a medieval past, why did they decide to use that to explain, or how did that interrelate with what they were experiencing in the 20th century? And of all times, you know, the 20th century, the American century, as you know, many like to call it, this era of great progress for America and movement forward and moving into a greater imperium. Why do they look back to a medieval past that wasn't even theirs to come up with an essence of various times? And so I was really interested in that. So I guess I ended up looking at things like I was interested in the whole idea of Camelot and why would an American president like John F. Kennedy imagine that his was Camelot? Why was Camelot important to them? So I was interested in the Arthurian thing. And then for the sort of epitome of that, you know, the golden age of America and the golden age of Camelot coalescing into Prince Valiant, that sort of that seemed like a logical thing for me to do. I really like the stories that are told about migration into America. And so the Thor comics was a really good example to then have a look at German migration, German and Scandinavian migration into America. A lot of people, even in America, don't understand how intense German migration into America was. And at the exact same moment, America begins to imagine medieval past, and by that I mean America moves into this period of medievalism after the American Civil War, and a lot of people are surprised to find out that German immigrants were the single biggest ethnic group that fought in the American Civil War. You know, following the situation into the economic collapse in Germany in the middle of the 19th century, millions of them are immigrating into America. They find themselves there as a civil war breaks out. And they enlist, and you know they're a massive part of, and you know, and then it doesn't stop there. I think by the turn of the century, there was something like I think there was more than 100 German language newspapers operating in America, and all these big names, like, you know, if you think about, you know, Budweiser and Boeing and all these big industrial names, they're all German, and so I was interested in looking at that something that had this this tradition of Odin and, you know, Woden and all this sort of thing, and it comes out of America, which is actually looking back at its Germanic past. So that was really interesting for me. What else? I was really interested in the stories that things like Red Sonja told us about tides of feminism in American thought. And so I found that a really, and of all the comic books I looked at, it seemed to be so precisely tied to those histories. When feminism was waxing, then it's pop, you know, it was selling really well. And then as feminism would you know, have these massive kickbacks against it, then the comic would fail and all these sorts of things. So I just found it really interesting. If what I'm trying to say is that the consumption of these things tell us something about our present lives, then I look for those examples that seem to really tie closely to that.
Yeah, and that brings me to one of my favorite case studies you have in the book. You highlighted Beowulf Dragonslayer as an exception, which proves the rule, you say. And these are, of course, beautiful illustrated comics. Illustrators Richard Villamonte, right? But I love his work so much. So I really like the style.
A lot of other comics. Like, he does a lot of really successful comics. So the style itself would have been real. The audience would have loved it. They would have known those things, you know? So yeah, he's selling a lot of comics, but not
exactly.
This one.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, which makes it so interesting. So could you explain how this series stands out in the corpus that you're working with and why you chose to analyze it?
Oh, for sure. And that's the thing. So you've got this, you've got an artist who's really famous and doing really great work. You've got Michael Arslan, who is really successful in so many other things himself as well. You know, incredibly, incredibly successful, which gives him enough power then within DC Comics to say, oh, I've got this dream. I really want to launch, you know, Beowulf. And you've got a situation where, I mean, you've got this situation where you've got a lot of people. American universities have this massive post-war boom, of course, thanks to the GI Bill. You know, they've got all these American service personnel that they're going to demobilize back into America, and so to make sure that they don't just go back into a suddenly depressed economy, America introduces the GI Bill, and part of that is a whole lot of these soldiers can go to university. And that leads to this massive boom in universities, where suddenly this small elite operation could suddenly, I mean, this is virtually where things like the lecture hall are invented, because now a university class isn't me and my four students sitting around in a room discussing literature. Suddenly I'm standing in front of a hall of 500 students. And this is an aside too, but I find one of the really interesting things is when America introduced the GI Bill, they really thought that what happened is a lot of the service personnel would use the chance to get a free education to go and do trades and things like that. But they hadn't counted on the cachet which university education held for a lot of people. And so a lot of people then, a lot of ordinary men and some women decided what they're going to do. They were going to get something that was completely unavailable to them before this. They're going to get a university education. And they're going to do things like liberal arts. They're going to do things like literature and history and philosophy. And so suddenly it completely changes all of this sort of thing. And we could talk lots about that too, but that's, I guess, another thing as well. But what I find really interesting about that is that then you get a lot of people studying, and this is where classics comes in. Like, classics is one of the big beneficiaries of this. By 1960, you've got something like 60,000 Americans teaching Latin because... Yeah, exactly. Because what had happened is that they'd gone to university, they'd done classics, they'd learned Latin, and then they're out in schools and all this sort of thing. It's an amazing, a blossoming of all these sorts of things, as well as medieval things. There's all sorts of stuff going on. And so what happens is that, I mean, this is where you get penguins from, as in not the birds, the books, right? Because what's happening after this is that they realize that suddenly there's this massive population of university students, and they need cheap paperback versions of these classic books. And so Penguin starts selling, and you've got all this classical literature, all these, you know, new translations of the Iliad, the Odyssey, but also English classics like Chaucer, but also Beowulf. And Aslan had gone to university. He'd studied Beowulf, and he went, like, this is the classic English text. If we can't make it, you know, it's a great story. It's a cracking read, and everyone's going to want to read this, right? Like, what's not to like? There's dragons. There's ogres. There's a hero. It's fantastic. And so he gets together with this great comic book writer, gets together with this great artist, and they produce this comic which just cannot sell. I just find it fascinating. Like, why can't it sell? Like, it's just, I'm just amazed by it. But I think the problem is, like, one of the problems that I go into is that it's probably not working on the level that people are actually studying it. And it's, you know, you've taken something which they know and you've turned it into too much sword and sorcery. They can get their sword and sorcery from something like Conan or something like that. They don't want to see this English epic tradition turned into a superhero story. But yeah, it's a very complex thing. And I'm fascinating, you know, how can you take Thor and turn that into this comic book, which goes for hundreds of issues and has now produced all these movies and all this? Why is Thor successful, but Beowulf not? It's just really interesting, I think.
Yeah, fascinating. I find it really fascinating. What are some other takeaways from this methodology of including the failures alongside the successful popular works? Because we so often hear about the big successes, the popular media. So I really appreciated the looking at the failures. How can we do more of that?
Yeah, well, I guess that goes back to what I was saying before. One of the great things about comics is that this isn't about a worthiness. It's not about literature. It's not about anybody saying, oh, this thing has to be done, so we'll put money into it. These are just pure capitalistic companies just going, we're going to produce this, and if we make money from it, we'll make more. And if we don't make money from it, it's dead. We'll get rid of it. And so what I love about the failure is it shows you. If you can't, you know, if you put something out there, you've got about probably – at this stage in the 60s, the 70s, even the 80s, before you get people actually directly subscribing for comics, these things are going out on newsstands. You've got maybe six issues. If by issue six it's not moving, it's gone. It's finished. And so we can actually get a sense of what the general public is thinking about these things. So it's not just about whether it's worthy and therefore we put money into it and it sells. Just if it's got no, you know, they'll do it as much as they can. They'll advertise it. They'll push it. They'll put good artists on it. They'll put good writers on it. But if they can't sell it, companies aren't interested. DC, Marvel, big companies, they just go, nah, that's it. You've had your chance. Do me another Batman.
And this brings up an interesting question, or I think is an interesting question. So these, for example, comic book adaptations of Beowulf might not be selling off of the newspaper stands, but we get a lot of academic literature about it. A lot of teachers are interested in this kind of thing in order to take them to the classroom and use them as a platform for teaching. So if I can ask, at least from how I see it, there seems to be a tension between the medieval literary canon and successful canonic medieval comics. Conan sells, Beowulf does not. So how can we scholars understand the difference between these favorites, the best of lists, and then when we talk about the canon proper and vice versa?
I honestly don't know. It's something I think about, but I can't come up with the answers. I think maybe the answer lies somewhere, like I was sort of hinting at before. There's some sort of, I wonder with Beowulf, in particular with Beowulf, has it been that the thing has been forced to carry all sorts of nationalistic expectations and concepts, and so it just can't manage popular entertainment. It's too worthy. And so when I introduce something like that, it's, you know, is that the problem? I go like, oh, you're ruining my literary history or something by turning that into something popular. Is that what's going on? I don't know. But I haven't seen ever a successful, maybe there's too many lecturers out there who are willing to complain about, you know, I mean, how much that we all get together and complain about new translations when they come out and all this sort of thing. Maybe it's too precious to us and we just can't stand anybody sullying it. You know, I've seen so many people get upset about just, yeah, even just translations. And then people get, I don't know where you are or how it is with you are, but people then just get upset about even people translating. Why do we have to translate? Why can't these people just go back and learn? It's old English. It's easy. They can learn that in a few months. Come on. They should be able to read this thing. And, you know, we shouldn't have to teach them at all. And I don't know. There's people out there now that can't even read Latin and Greek. What's going on with the world? Maybe it's carried too much nationalistic pretension with it to make that movement into popular culture.
And also just the single source manuscript versus Arthuriana is quite open, what we would say open universe, you know, you can add new stories on there, right?
Oh, that's an interesting, look, I hadn't thought about it, but that's a good point. That's a really good point. You know, well, I've got to say one of the things then, I don't know, you probably get your listeners looking to lynch me for this one, but one of the things I find interesting about Beowulf is, like, exactly right. It's a single source. It's a single late source. The whole thing is written in very clearly a 10th century West Saxon dialect. It's really clear to me. And I got to say, when I read it in the original, it's also really clear to me it was written by a single individual. Like, I know the manuscript has evidence of two hands. That doesn't mean anything. I don't think it was an ancient book. I don't think it was written hundreds of years before it was. There's no evidence whatsoever of almost anybody in Old England even knowing about this book. You know, I don't find place names. I don't find anyone referencing the heroes in it. We get no other reference to this. It just reads to me like a cracking good piece of poetry written by probably a cleric that comes out of that, you know, 10th century Reformation movement in England. It's got amazing classical references. It clearly, this is a man or a woman who knew their Aeneid. There's those sorts of things, but it's in their own language, and then it just gets forgotten. You know, I think it's incredibly telling that the copy that turns up, the single copy that turns up, has a massive beer stain on it. Someone's put their tankard of beer on that in a monastery somewhere, or a tankard of wine, or whatever it was. Not even worth, you know, and there it sits for hundreds of years until someone, you know, relocates it. And what do they relocate it for? Well, mainly the stories in the same manuscript. You know, there's other stories of St. Christopher there, which are interesting to them. So they, oh, and there's this other poem there. And then it gets turned into this nationalist epic, you know, at the same time that England is trying to say to its, you know, to everybody, oh, look, we've got our own Iliad. We've got our own, look at this. This is just as good. And we'll drag that out. And the British Empire is big enough to push this idea that this is a national epic for us. I'm sure the cleric who wrote in the 10th century never saw that happening with this piece. Don't get me wrong. It's an absolutely sublime poem. But I don't see how it can, you know, carry all this, you know, these national desires with it.
I don't want to get you in trouble, but if I can just ask you, what do you think about these theories that maybe Shakespeare had gotten hold of the Beowulf manuscript and read it and tied in some inspiration to Hamlet and things like this? Is this more of our contemporary national myth-making, or
does 100%. There's no way. There's just no way. And in my mind, look, maybe I'll be shown to be wrong somewhere down the track, but like, I've seen that stuff. Let's just be straight. Like, let's be honest with this. And in fact, Shakespeare's not really coy about where he's getting his ideas from. Like, he's, you know, he we can see where he gets his ideas from. He doesn't bother changing a lot of stuff. If he thinks it's good enough, and then he adds to these, you know, where he wants to. The reality is that he is getting his inspiration from the same place that the Beowulf poet got their inspiration from. It's, you know, they're clearly reading other literature, and they're getting ideas. As I was just saying with Beowulf, it's really obvious to me with you know, reading the Aeneid in Latin, and then you read Beowulf in Old English. You know, the bit around the mire when he's going in to fight Grendel's mother, it's very obvious that he's, and it's not like he's doing what all good writers do. He's going, oh, here's a nod to another. We all know Aaron Ead. I'm making a nod to that, but I'm taking us in a different place now. You know, that's beautiful. He does that sort of, or she does that sort of thing. But Shakespeare, the ideas that Shakespeare has in common with a Beowulf poet, I think that's because they're getting it from the same ultimate inspiration from somewhere else. There's a lot of translations of classical works in Shakespeare's time, and we know that he's reading those and he's getting ideas. His Latin was good enough to be reading Latin texts. He was getting these ideas from there.
Yeah, and I think we also see a lot of this blending and mixing and matching in medieval comics as well, where it's not just properly medieval, right? They do jump around.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. It's a worry for us. Like, there's so much of art that we look at. Like, so many great parts of the canon of Western art where we look at and we know that they're stealing ideas from here and there, or it's a reference. Like, it's all we do. I don't know why people get upset that we muck around with those sorts of things. Think of all the great art you can think of that has pictures of Zeus and Apollo dressed in medieval armor, because that's the way they want them to appear, or Baroque armor, early modern armor, because that's who they're painting for. And like, that's okay, but I don't. I think as these things get pushed into a nationalist agenda, everyone starts to talk about purity.
And that leads really nicely into the next question I wanted to ask you. So you identified so many elements of these medievalist comics as not being medieval at all. So for example, Northlanders as having kung fu adventure elements, and the 1980s feminism of Red Sonja and things like this are all under the banner of medieval. What does this mean? Can you give us some concrete interpretations or how we should approach these? Do readers even notice these things?
No, I don't think they. I don't think they do. In fact, I have had communication with people who disagree with my opinion about Northlanders, which is amusing because my actual understanding of Northlanders comes from the author himself. But the reality was that he wanted to sell a yakuza, Japanese crime story to the comic book company. And they went, no, we're not doing Japanese crime. All indications of market research say Vikings. And he's saying, oh, but I want to do this yakuza thing. They went, no, we'll give you money to do a Vikings thing. And then he went, well, what if I just imagined I took my yakuza story and I turned it into a Viking story? It'd work. It's got the same sorts of elements. There's swords, there's lone individuals coming in, in a town, blah, blah. Yeah, that's what he wanted to do. So we know from, what he said about his own work that's what he's doing. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what artists do. Artists, take from all these different sources. I've forgotten your question now. Just went off on a tangent. What was I supposed to be answering?
Okay. Just this sort of general question about how much our readers may be aware of the actual underpinnings, if we can even say there are actual underpinnings of things. And you're right. There's really clear statements by the people who work on these types of comics projects. We can ask, oh, is our ethereal intent really real? And things like that. But there are clear statements.
Yeah, I don't know. There probably are those. There are those people out there too. I don't know. I try not to. I certainly don't want to end up in a movie theater with those people who sit next to you going, oh, that's the wrong belt buckle. There's those dudes who you're watching a TV show and they go, oh, this is supposed to be 1127. Those helmets didn't come into 1174. And you go, really? That's what you're going to say about this movie? But there are people like that. And sometimes I can feel like but that myself, I suppose. But I think everything that we, I don't know. I don't even know what the point of creating a completely historic medieval comic would be. Like, I guess if you wanted to create a completely historic Beowulf, I would probably say maybe just go read Beowulf. Because that actually is a completely historic Beowulf. It's of the 10th century, and you can immerse yourself into that, even though it imagines itself set much further back in the past and imagined past to them. I mean, Beowulf is our imagined past, but what's actually happening in the events to the 10th century writer is imagined in the 6th or 5th century as well. So that's the sort of thing we do. I think if we're going to create modern things, we're always going to have an imagined past. We're always going to create imagined past, whether it's, you know, a 19th century past or a 15th century past or a, you know, 2,500 BCE past. That's what we're going to do. So I think just embrace that. I think if you're going to get caught up in the historicity of things, it's probably just a waste of everybody's time.
And a proper medieval comic might be a little boring with the day to day.
Well, and I wonder what you could do with a proper medieval comic that hasn't been done. Like, I think the reality is sometimes for people, and remember that comics are appealing to a different crowd often, but you know, the reality is there's actually, like, you know, there's a ton of great medieval literature written in the Middle Ages. It's there. You can just go and access that. There's nothing wrong with reading these, you know, just go and read them. And these are of their time, and they give you such a sense of it. And I think for us as academics sometimes too, if I'm reading something, I'm reading Marjorie Kemp or Catherine de Pizan, I get a real sense of the era because I've got an authentic voice telling me about what they're experiencing. That's all I need. If I want medieval, I'll get it from someone who lived in the Middle Ages.
And can I ask, do you see similar trends in your work on adaptations of other literatures or eras including more recent histories getting adapted for some sort of contemporary purpose?
I haven't really looked at that. What I've looked at is the tension between classicism and medievalism. So certainly I've written and published on classical motifs, which come into not just comic books, but also video games as another form of popular culture. Another thing that we can monitor, because we can see how many copies of a video game, like a console game, sells. We can see also, you know, if there's online playing, we can see how many people engaging, that sort of thing. So again, it's a nice check of how popular, you know, which games sell well, which games are people buying into, which they want to immerse themselves in. So I've looked at that as well. So I'm really interested in much older things. I'm sure I can think of some video games that people should be looking at. I think anything that if 19th century, there's games which imagine the American West, for instance, and they would be interesting to look at in terms of the way we want, say, Americans might want to create their imagined past from such a relatively recent. But I have looked at lots of classical comics and classical elements that seep into video games. But I would say one of the things that I have come up with is also just, actually, it goes back to the question about Shakespeare in a sense. It's also just that ancient impulse, as in, in a sense of a signature running through things. When you're looking at the way that people interpret things, is it a conscious reception or is it an unconscious reception? If I'm going to do a story about a traveler, and this traveler goes through all these different adventures, am I consciously receiving, say, the Odyssey? Or is it that the Odyssey is so much a part of Western civilization that I can't help but create an Odyssey-like story without even thinking about it? And one of the articles I published was on, in fact, the Silver Surfer. So this is a extraterrestrial superhero, which comes out of the early issues of the Fantastic Four, and he's scouring the universe. And to me, he's very obviously an Ulysses analog. And I looked at, is it a deliberate analog, or is it just that story is so heavily inculcated into Western civilization? When I do the lone traveler surfing through space, he sort of can't be anything but Ulysses. And in the end, I decided that's what was actually happening. I don't think, looking at what the authors were saying, I don't think it was conscious at all. They just were so programmed by thousands of years of this reception, they just went, oh, that's what's going to look like.
And you're right, it would be also very interesting when we can spend more time looking at video game narratives and how it manifests there.
Totally, I published different. On one video game, which is there's a series of post-apocalyptic games that came out of a Ukrainian company. So these are based on a Russian novel, Metro 2033. or a series of novels. And I was really interested in that because basically it's although it's set in a post-apocalyptic Russia, imagining apocalypse in the very near future, but there's a lot of reference to Stalinist architecture and all that sort of thing through it. Now, Stalin, of course, used this neoclassical architecture because, again, if you go back to my earlier thesis, that as nationalism gets abandoned for imperialism, classical motifs are a better way of describing yourself. And I was really interested to see if the use of classical architecture in this post-apocalyptic Russia was a reference to the fall of communism, or if in fact it was a reference back to ancient classicism. And I think that I end up with this whole white noise theory that these things run as impulses through our culture so heavily, sometimes people don't even know they're borrowing from it. So if I want to do a classical thing instead, but you know, at the same time, if I want to do medievalist things like for Western civilization, the impulse of, you know, of the church, of Christianity, this is so heavily inculcated. Can I ever really abandon it? It's, you know, I might want to think that I'm creating this story, but I've been programmed by thousands of years of art and literature to think in a particular way.
And if I can ask you a question kind of off the cuff, you mentioned how we use the medieval to imagine our past, to contextualize our present. What about these comics where the Middle Ages are placed as a future, usually like a kind of post-apocalyptic future? Could you interpret that for us really quickly? I'm thinking about comics like Mercenaries, Sagrellis Mercenaries, or even like Vampirella is in an outer space, a spooky medieval vampire, Alien, things like that.
Yeah, and there's also imaginations of Greek and Egyptian, very serious Greek and Egyptian gods in the future as it like being all space travelers and all that sort of stuff gets tied in with Eric von Däniken and the whole sort of, you know, that whole sort of mess. Actually, I think some Egyptian god space travelers turn up in Beowulf as well. I think that there's two ways of viewing history in the popular sense, and I think people are interested in a history of a downward trajectory or an upward trajectory. We like to just, and this is very broad, but I think people like to imagine that we're getting worse or that we're getting better. And having taught history at university for a long time, I've never found anyone who's happy with history just goes on flat. You know, students never want to hear that. They ask me, what do I think? And I go, I reckon we've pretty much been doing the same stuff forever. And there's just this minor variation, but we just keep doing the same thing over and over again. And we never learn from the past and we just keep doing it. Students don't like that one. Most people, I think, like to think of us getting better. And so we like to, you know, and so you could take the utopian medieval past and you could project it into a utopian medievalist future, and that's a great place to be. Or if you want the downward trajectory, I'll take my dystopian medieval past and I'll project it into a dystopian medieval future, and lo and behold, I've just proved what I always thought was going to happen anyway, because that's kind of what humans do, you know?
So kind of that same function, but just projected into the future.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I don't know how you found it, but I find that teaching history, a lot of people aren't aware of how much they want to manipulate history to tell themselves a story about themselves. They think that they're there, yeah. They think that they're there to, I want to find out what happened. You go, do you really? Or do you just want to make yourself feel better about yourself now? And that's okay. But yeah, let's be honest with it.
Full disclosure, I was very interested in Renaissance festivals as a kid. So we find ourselves here today.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And full disclosure, and I often say mm-hmm. this to my students too. Like, here's the thing. Okay, so I'm talking about this dystopian or this utopian past, which one am I more attracted to? And also which one am I almost programmed to go towards? And I one of the things I've realized is that I am programmed towards utopian medieval past, all right? And I think a lot of that is, I've taught at the ANU for a long time, but I also taught at Catholic Uni for a few semesters. And I was really interested when I started teaching medievalism in the course, you know, so you've got your students there, and you go, let's brainstorm this idea. I put medieval up on the board. What are your ideas? And inevitably people go, sickness, plague, black death, rats, you know, and I'm writing them all up on the board, all the bad things. And I go, yeah, exactly. So then I will talk about this weird view we have of the past and how it was dystopic. I did 3 semesters teaching at a Catholic uni here in Australia. So I did exactly the same thing, put it up on the board. Okay, so when I say medieval, what do you think of? And they go, oh, knights. Maidens, the church. And I was going, wow, this is all really positive. And then I thought, actually, yeah, because full disclosure, I'm from a Catholic background, and I realized that I had probably inherited from my, you know, just the culture around me, this sort of utopic view of this age of faith, when we were simpler and we, you know, all this sort of thing. And we built these wonderful, massive churches, which are these incredible, you know, and they are, they're incredible architectural phenomena. And so, yeah, I think we also have to realize, yeah, we did get programmed by these things. So you're saying Renaissance fairs, like, how can you not be attracted to the concept of Renaissance? Do you know what I mean? Like, it just sounds so perfect. And the art is so beautiful, and all these sorts of things. Yeah, I think we carry this stuff with us, and we have to, and I can be sitting there, you know, saying, oh, well, we do all these. I do these things too. Like, we all do these things. But by understanding our biases, we can possibly be less controlled by them.
And aware of positionality and all that good stuff. Yeah,
for sure.
Can I ask you, were there any comics that you were interested in that you didn't have space to address in the book, or that you discovered after writing the book that you think would be interesting for analysis?
No, I didn't in the end. I kept the ones I thought really worked really well. There were lots of other comic books which I found interesting for various reasons. And I suppose some of the things too, like I could have looked at Neil Gaiman's Sandman, for instance. That would have been really good, but plenty has been written about that. I probably did look. There was a comic book representation of the Elric series, Michael Moorcock's fantasy series, and that would have been interesting. But then I thought, yeah, but is it a comic book, or is it a comic version of a series of novels, and would it be better, you know, studied as a series of novels rather than, well, I get more out of that. So it got shelved off for another project, which never got written up in the way of things. So there's plenty of other things. And I tell you what, if people out there are looking for projects, there's plenty of projects still to be worked on, and more stuff every day. You know, more and more titles being done. It'll be harder to tell how they're doing in the modern world, because we don't have those newspaper stands to tell us exact numbers, but there's still plenty of projects to be done. And then you can start looking at that translation of comic projects into silver screen projects. That would be really interesting as well.
Thank you. And to wrap up, could you tell us a little bit about some of the projects you're working on now, or some of the things you're excited about, interested in now?
I will. So I'm being a bit guarded about it. Look, and that's because I have radically changed this year. So in terms of projects I'm working on, there's nothing collaborative there. I finished up at the Australian National University in January of this year, and I have become a lot less interested in the way that universities in Australia at least are running. And I have become very, very interested in public education. And so I have become a school teacher. So I'm very interested in working in literacy areas. And so I'm teaching what here is called essential English. So I'm working with people often from non-English speaking backgrounds, but also I'm working with a lot of young people from Indigenous backgrounds, First Nations Australians. And that's what I've been working on. I don't know if any publications will come out of that. At the moment, I'm just working to keep my my students in school and to you know, give them some options once they leave. So I'm really excited about it. I'm really enjoying it, but it's nothing academic. But I just got to this point where I really love teaching classics and all those sorts of things, but I just thought I wanted to have maybe it's all the Catholic background, right? It's all the vocational things which the brothers and the nuns forced into my head when I was a child and I never noticed, but I felt like I should be doing something broader, I guess. And so I have just started teaching literacy in schools.
Will you be using comic books in the classroom?
I've already done so. It's a very, and you know what, like obviously there's a lot of comics out there which are still literature, and there's also a lot of comics which aren't literature but still teach good literacy skills. And everything we do about film, we can do about comics, we can develop the same meta language with my students. And the big thing I'm finding, I don't want to working with my students, I want to give them the same opportunities. And so there's no point in not going into things like meta language, explaining how things are done. And comics are really good. There's all sorts of, it's everything we can do there. And it seems obvious and immediate and accessible. So yeah, there's lots of things we can do. And of course, comics deal with all sorts of social issues, and we can use them as springboards then off into talking about these sorts of things. And yeah, they're a wonderful resource.
I wholeheartedly agree. Well, Chris, thank you so much for your time today. It was a treat to talk to you about this book and this topic, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.